The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 330, Beyond Fertility, What We Don't Know About Utah Women, by Marie Cornwall.
Utah women. The presenter today is Marie Cornwall, who's an associate professor of sociology at BYU. This past year, she has been on leave from the Y and was a visiting professor at the University of Utah, holding the Bell Spafford Chair in the Graduate School of Social Work. And her project for her year as the Bell Spafford Scholar was to do research on how Utah women compare to women nationally. What are the samenesses? What are the differences? And it's the result of that research which she'll be presenting today in her paper. She is also working this material that will be published in a book to be published sometime when she gets it done. And she is also, this material will also be part of several television documentaries on Channel 7 this spring, and that project she's working with a world famous television producer to do those. So here's Marie.
I need to introduce my world-famous television producer, Louise Dane, who is really producing those television programs. We've been working on it this summer, having a lot of fun. I've titled this paper, Beyond Fertility, What We Don't Know About Utah Women, an effort to wake a few people up in terms of the kinds of things we could know if we looked at the data more carefully. The stereotypical view of Utah women is that they have many children and are devoted full-time homemakers and mothers. But a more accurate view of Utah women is that they are much like other women in the United States, with only a few exceptions. This stereotype is perhaps well-earned, a function of the predominance of Mormons, a religion which emphasizes a family-focused lifestyle and distinct gender roles. And historically high fertility rates have also contributed to this image of Utah women. Two examples demonstrate the dominant view. I recently traveled to a women's studies conference in central Poland, where I met with women from the United States and Eastern Europe. Utah, I explained to the group, was way out west in the United States. A distinguished colleague and director of a well-known Eastern women's studies group quipped, "You just think you're a part of the United States, but you're not really." My response was, "We say that about people in New Jersey, too." More recently, a headline in the Salt Lake Tribune read, "The Ups and Downs of Prozac, Utah's Favorite Drug." The reporter quoted a distinguished psychiatrist as saying, "The typical Utahn taking Prozac frequently is a housewife overwhelmed with a lot of children. She's not able to deal with an unresolved problem with a marriage and wants a solution. She will say to her doctor that she is kind of depressed and they will prescribe it. What she really needs is family counseling or therapy." Now, he later claimed that he had been terribly misquoted. The letters to the editor which followed over the next week demonstrated how much this article had touched a nerve. Letter writers offered evidence for both sides of the ensuing argument. Utahns were prone to overuse of prescription drugs, some argued. Others questioned the facts, citing that no data are available to know whether or not Utahns use more Prozac than people in other states. The reporter had not provided any evidence of whether Prozac use was higher in Utah or not, but she didn't need to because the description of the typical Prozac user fit the stereotypical view of Utah women. Once again, the media had reinforced the stereotype. Utah women are primarily depressed and bedraggled, unable to control their children or communicate with their husbands, but very good at manipulating doctors who prescribe medication they do not need. The stereotype lives on because not much information is available about Utah women. Social scientists no longer study Utah as a means to understanding the Mormon culture. Mormonism has expanded so far beyond the boundaries of Utah that the data would not be generalizable. And state-produced reports are, for the most part, insufficient when it comes to describing women's lives. A state vital statistics report provides fertility rates. The Statistical Abstract of Utah, published annually, reports population data by race and sex. State reports such as these provide marriage and divorce statistics, birth and death rates, enrollments in institutions of higher education, degrees awarded, median family income, poverty status of Utah families, and many other statistics. But more times than not, there is no breakdown of the data by sex for either individuals or household heads. Probably the most studied aspect of Utah women's lives over the past 15 years has been teenage pregnancy. A report appears every 5 years using state vital statistics data. Teenage pregnancy should be a concern for all of us because of the long-term disadvantage experienced both by the child and the mother. The good news is that the fertility rate among 15 to 19-year-old women has declined in Utah during the past decade, although there has been a slight resurgence among 18 and 19-year-old women since 1988. And also, since 1975, the abortion rate has remained relatively low. So the lower fertility rate is not a function of increased abortions. But the several reports that are now available about teenage pregnancies tell us nothing about the fathers of these babies. Just who are these fathers? Are they teenagers as well? Or would we find that a significant percentage of the fathers of these babies are young men in their 20s? Why is it that analysis of vital statistics records do not include an analysis of the presence and age of fathers? Perhaps it is because of the way the problem has been defined. Hard at Work, Women in the Utah Labor Force, a report published by the Utah Department of Employment Security, is a stunning example of the type of data that can be made available about Utah women when local government officials recognize the need. While the state regularly collects information about labor force participation and wages paid to Utah workers, no data are available regarding the sex of the worker. Hence, it is not possible to track the progress of efforts to reduce the wage gap between men and women in Utah. Recent efforts to enact a state law requiring that sex be included in wage and occupation reports was defeated by a strong business lobby, despite the fact that a trial test of the procedure demonstrated little, if any, additional cost to the employer. Utah state legislators and policymakers need more data about Utah women's lives. Social science research is most useful to the extent that it enlightens policymakers about the real-world situation of those whose background and experiences differ from their own. Since Utah government officials are predominantly white, middle-class males, the availability of data about Utah women is that much more important. The patterns of women's lives are changing rapidly. Labor force participation, fertility rates, job growth, age at marriage, educational attainment, all these indicators about what women's lives are like have changed dramatically in the last 30 years. Many of these changes are driven by the women's movement, but many are also driven by macro-level economic forces. The impact of such forces has been to alter men's and women's lives in very different ways, and the changes have been greater for women than for men. Changes like the influx of women into the labor force and the increasing vulnerability of women and children to the possibility of poverty have greater implications for the way women prepare for adulthood than for the way men do. The increase in numbers of women completing college degrees and graduate studies, as well as the increase in labor force participation of women in all age groups, have required adjustments in family life and in the interface between family and school and family and work. The most important reason for having data about Utah women is that women need to know who they are collectively so that they can also understand who they are as individuals. Just as Utah's landscape is highly diverse, Utah women are a diverse group. The dominance of one religious perspective and genetic type makes it easy for visitors or a newcomer to miss the variety of the lived lives of individual women. Old-timers are also prevented from seeing the diversity in that their vision is based on gendered stereotypes rather than the reality of women's lives. Utah is known for its high fertility rate. In 1980, the fertility rate for Utah was 122 births per 1,000 women aged 15 to 44. By comparison, the same rate was 68 births per 1,000 women nationally. If we compare Utah birth fertility rates with the fertility rates for the U.S. using only the white population in the U.S. because Utah is so dominantly white, we find that in 1980, the fertility rate for Utah was almost twice that of the rest of the nation. Utahns actually produced a small baby boom of their own in the late 70s, at the very time that the birth rate in the rest of the United States was decreasing rapidly. But this is not the full story. Utah women's fertility rate declined by 25% between 1980 and 1990. By 1990, the fertility rate was 91.6 births per 1,000 women, still higher than the national rates, but only one-third higher, not twice as high. The stereotypical Utah woman has several children at home, is fully dependent on her husband for financial support, and devotes herself full-time to family responsibilities. Just how many Utah women fit this image? According to the 1990 census, only 12% of women age 16 and older are married, full-time homemakers with children under 18. Nationally, that number is 8%. So it's still higher in Utah. But part of that is that Utah's population is younger. So let's confine our typical woman to a particular age group, say women of child-rearing age 16 to 50. We find that 12% are full-time homemakers with children under 6, and 17% are full-time homemakers with children under 18. In the U.S. generally, the numbers are 7 and 12%. Not quite so different. In 1980, 25% of Utah women aged 16 and older had children under 18, were married, and were not employed. 10 years later, the combined effect of women's lowered fertility, later marriage, and higher labor force participation reduced by half the number of women who were living what at one time would have been considered the typical life for women. So it was low in 1980 because of life cycle changes or whatever, but by 1990 it had declined by half again. Economics appears to be a significant force in the changing behavior of women in Utah and nationally. Since 1960, the number of women in the labor force has almost doubled. Today, the labor force participation rate of Utah women is just slightly higher than the national average. According to 1990 census data, 76% of Utah women with children aged 6 to 17 are employed. That's more than three-fourths. The percent of employed mothers with children under 6 increased 52% in that decade, from 37% to 59%. Almost 6 out of 10 mothers of young children are employed, and 3 out of 10 work 40 or more hours per week. So the typical Utah woman is married and employed. About half work less than a 40-hour week, but the others have full-time jobs, and they have 2 to 3 children at home. By comparison, U.S. women are somewhat less likely to be married. That's primarily because they marry in their late 20s rather than their early 20s like Utah women. They are just as likely to be employed as Utah women, but more likely to be employed full-time, and they have 1 or 2 children at home. So in terms of the working pattern, employment, and all of that, much of it is very much the same. The difference is that Utah women have, on average, about 1 more child at home. One might expect the pronouncements from LDS church leaders against mothers' employment and directives to fathers that they provide financially for the family would discourage women's employment in Utah. Furthermore, the anti-feminist position of conservative state legislatures might provide women an added incentive to maintain traditional gendered roles. If Utah is so patriarchal, why don't Utah women behave consistent with the expectations of the patriarchy? Declining fertility, later marriage, and the labor force participation rates of Utah women suggest they are experiencing the same social and economic changes as women nationally. They appear to be about a decade behind the U.S. women in some of the changes, for example, age at marriage. But the changes are occurring. Perhaps the most significant force which is producing change in women's lives can be found in the changing economics. Full-time homemaking has always been a privilege granted mostly to white middle-class women. But changing economic conditions have made such privileges more difficult to obtain for the women who want them. Between 1979 and 1989, per capita income in Utah increased 4%. Nationally, per capita income increased 18%. Now, keep in mind that one of the things that influences this data is that Utah was still in a recession when the 1990 data were taken. Now, Utah is not in a recession now. Utah is doing very well. So, but I still think that the numbers I'm going to give you are very instructive. Researchers have documented the declining value of the male wage and the increasing pressures on women to contribute to family earnings. The new significance of women's wages for the financial security of their families is demonstrated by examining how women's contribution to family earnings changed during the 80s in Utah. In 1979, just over one-third of all married couples were supported by the husband's earnings alone. By 1989, less than one-fourth were supported by husband's earnings. Adjusting for inflation again, the median family income for families where only the husband was employed was 19% lower in 1989 than it had been in 1979. By comparison, the median family income for families where both husband and wife were employed was only 9% lower in 1979. The wife's contribution to family earnings increased during the decade. Husband's earnings in married couple families where both spouses worked was 15% lower in 1989 than in 1979. The wife's contribution to family earnings in these families was 29.4% in 1989, where it had only been 24% in 1979. Therefore, women played a significant role in maintaining the family income as Utah families met the challenges of the recession economy. The wife's contribution to family income increased the greatest for husband and wife families with children under 6 years of age. The earning power of these families was actually a little higher in 1989 than it was in 1979. But that was only because the wife's contribution to family earnings increased dramatically. From about 20% to 27% over the decade. The financial significance of women's employment for sustaining family income levels has increased throughout the United States, but the decline in median family earnings was greater for Utah families than for families across the nation, partly because Utah was still in a recession when the 1990 census was taken. The movement of women into the labor force has been both a result of economic forces pushing them into the labor force and the pull of a particular sector of the labor market that was expanding during the 80s. In Utah, while jobs were disappearing in mining and construction, the services sector expanded by 80%. There were new jobs in computer and data processing services, entertainment and recreation, health and nursing services, libraries and other educational services, accounting and bookkeeping, research and development, management, and public relations. Almost half of these jobs were filled by women. In fact, Utah women, like women nationally, are more likely to be employed in the service industries than in any other area of the economy. Now, the wage gap is larger in Utah than in most other states. In fact, Utah is among the top 20% of states in the nation with the largest wage gap between men and women. That is, there's only about four other states that are with as big a wage gap as Utah. Why is the wage gap greater in Utah than elsewhere? There are a number of reasons why women's wages tend to be lower than men's, generally. First of all, because women take time out for childbearing and child-rearing, their accumulated years on the job is typically less than men's. Scholars have predicted that as women's labor force participations change, as they take less time away from jobs to give birth to and care for children, the wage gap will narrow. And in fact, it is narrowing nationally. from in the early 80s, it was 61 cents on the dollar. The latest statistics that I just saw this past week is that it's 76 on the dollar, 76 cents on the dollar for women nationally. Utah women are a little bit lower. Based on those projections, I would suspect the Utah women's wage gap right now would be about 70 cents on the dollar. Women tend to dominate occupations where less skill and training is required. This is particularly true for older women who return to the labor force after raising children and in response to economic pressures. Again, as women obtain skills by obtaining more education which qualify them for better jobs, the concentration of women in less skilled positions will likely change. While women have made tremendous headway moving into professional, managerial, and financial occupations, the top jobs are still dominated by men. Many occupations are now more open to women, but sociologists tell us that the movement of women into traditionally male occupations is largely regulated by labor market factors. When job growth exceeds the pool of trained men which are available to fill the expanding occupational queues, more opportunity opens up for women. When an occupation that was formerly dominated by men becomes more equally balanced or even female-dominated, the average salary for the occupation tends to decline. Research also suggests that while men's earnings increase as they age, women's earnings are less likely to do so. This, of course, is partly due to women's lack of access to the top levels of corporate, government, and educational institutions. Since women are not as likely to be promoted as men, their earnings remain relatively flat over the life of their career. Social scientists and economists have long predicted that the wage gap will narrow as women become more educated, spend more of their lives in the labor force, and move into typically male occupations. In fact, nationally, the wage gap has narrowed, as I said. Even so, only about half of the existing wage gap can be explained by structural characteristics of the labor market. The rest remains unexplained and likely due to gender discrimination. Now, all these factors would be as true for women nationally as it is for women in Utah. Utah women have moved into professional and managerial occupations at about the same rate as women nationally. The one exception is that Utah women are much less likely to be in technical occupations, engineers, science technicians, and computer programmers, etc. This is a problem given the fact that many of the professional careers in Utah are in those various areas. If we think about WordPerfect and engineering companies that are around. Furthermore, the fact that Utah women have slightly larger families and are more likely to work part-time while managing family and parenting duties during the child-rearing years may contribute to the larger wage gap. One reason for Utah's wage gap may be the relatively large gap in the educational attainment for women and men. Utah's educational attainment has always been high. The numbers of residents who graduate from high school and attend college is much higher in Utah than in other states. And this appears to be so for minority peoples in the state as well. While 85% of Utahns graduate from high school, only 75% of U.S. citizens do. While 58% of Utahns have at least some college education, only 45% of the national population do. However, the relative educational attainment of Utah women as compared with Utah men is large. Utah has the largest educational gap of any state in the nation. If we consider the proportion of men and women who graduate from high school, we find a great deal of equality, 86% for both. When we ask how many women and men have had at least some college-level training beyond high school, we find that about two-thirds of Utah men have such training, while only a little over half of Utah women do. And if we ask how many Utah men have graduated from college, we find the answer to be almost 3 out of 10. But less than 1 in 5 Utah women have graduated from college. Now, it's an interesting problem. It is not that Utah women are less educated than women nationally. In fact, the percent of women with some college training is higher in Utah than nationally, and the percent of women with a bachelor's degree or more is approximately the same. The problem is more one of equity. Utah men are more likely than U.S. men to obtain a bachelor or postgraduate degree, while Utah women are about as likely to obtain a bachelor's degree and much less likely to obtain a graduate degree as women nationally. While 7% of U.S. women report they have a graduate degree, only 4% of Utah women do so. I think what we can summarize is that the quality of life for Utah residents is very good overall. However, the quality of life among men in Utah is often better than the quality of life among women. The higher rates of educational attainment is one example. Let me just say a little more about that. What's interesting is if you compare Utah women with women nationally, as I've said, on many indicators you don't see that much difference. But when you compare Utah women with Utah men, you see a greater difference. So the question is, if life is so good in Utah, can it be better, even better for women? Okay. Last year, the Utah Economic and Business Review reported two significant findings based on analysis of the educational attainment of labor force participants. Utah is the only state in the nation where the rate of college degree attainment for working women aged 25 to 29 does not exceed the rate of college degree attainment of working men of the same age. In all states, the proportion of women attaining degrees relative to men has increased remarkably, but the ratio of educational attainment for working women relative to working men is the lowest in Utah of all the states in the nation. So how do we account for this educational gap? Among other things, we find a marriage gap. The marriage pattern for Utah women is substantially different from the marriage patterns of Utah men and men and women nationally. According to the 1990 census, 47% of Utah women aged 20 to 24 were never married, compared to 64% of U.S. women, 79% of U.S. men, and 71% of Utah men. Not only do Utah women marry younger than U.S. women, but they also marry younger than Utah men. Now, marriage patterns account for some of the educational gap, but not all. In 1991, 54% of students enrolled in institutions of higher education in the United States were women. In the Mountain States, 53% were women. In Utah, 49% of enrollees were women. In 1992, one quarter of all women enrolled in state institutions of higher education were students at the... let me start that over. In 1992, one quarter of all women enrolled in state institutions of higher education were students at the University of Utah, the largest university in the state, the largest state university. By comparison, 3 out of 10 male students were enrolled. Only 44% of University of Utah bachelor degrees were awarded to women in 1993, and there has been little change in these statistics for the past 5 years. In 1989, only 42% of bachelor's degrees were awarded to women. Other state institutions have improved both the enrollment of women and the percent of women receiving degrees. Utah State went from 41% to 46% in 5 years. Weber State went from 40% to 48%. Southern Utah State went from 46% to 56%. And even BYU, who went from 43% to 49%, all have increased the proportion of women receiving college degrees in the last 5 years. The University of Utah has not. While women's enrollment at all colleges and universities in the state has increased 32% over the past 5 years, it increased only 15% at the University of Utah. Women are going other places. And yet the University of Utah is supposedly our premier state institution. While men receive 54% of all bachelor's degrees conferred at state institutions, women receive 57% of all associate degrees. In a state where educational funds are limited and the numbers of students seeking degrees is ever increasing, educators have little incentive to improve the balance between women and men in educational attainment by giving special attention to the educational needs of women. Now, the good news is that a greater proportion of young adult women are enrolled in colleges and universities in Utah than ever before. Comparisons with 1980 census data suggest that the percent of young women ages 21 to 24 enrolled in school has increased by more than 60%. Yes, Utah women are still marrying at comparatively younger ages than women nationally. However, they appear to be about as likely to be enrolled in school as women nationally, which is another reason why we just can't blame it just on marriage, because the young women, while they're getting married, they seem to be staying in school. The need to track the changing significance and implications of such things as the marriage gap, the wage gap, and the educational gap for women is apparent in the statistics on poverty in the state of Utah. Utah ranks 26th among all states in the percent of white children under 6 living in poverty. Now, a number one ranking means the state has the lowest child poverty rate, and we're 26th. The numbers are even more startling for minority children. Hispanics are the largest minority group in Utah, comprising approximately 5% of the population. One-third of Hispanic children under 6 live in poverty. A little more than one-third of Afro-American children live in poverty. Utah ranks 43rd, that is, almost at the very bottom, among all states in the nation in percent of Native American children living in poverty. Half of these children live in poverty. The recently published report on poverty to the governor of Utah concluded, Utah's overall family poverty rates are lower than those in the nation as a whole. Unfortunately, further data analysis reveals less positive conclusions. When we examine poverty rates while taking into account both marital status and sex of the head of the house and race or ethnic group membership, we find that some categories of Utah families actually experience higher rates of poverty than their counterparts nationally. Among whites, less than 1 in 10 married couple families with children under 18 live in poverty, one-tenth, while more than one-third of female-headed families live in poverty. But that's among the whites. While the poverty rate for married couple families is while the poverty rate for married couple families is lower than the national rate, the poverty rate of Utah female-headed families with children under 18 is actually slightly higher than nationally. We find the same pattern for blacks in Utah. While only 7% of the married couple families with children under 18 live in poverty, which is actually lower than the percent nationally, fully two-thirds of Utah's black female-headed households with children under 18 live in poverty. Among Native Americans, almost one-third of married couple families with children, but fully two-thirds of female-headed families with children live in poverty. This is a much higher rate of poverty than their counterparts nationally experience. Among Asians and Pacific Islanders, poverty rate for female-headed families is 41%. Nationally, it's 36%. The poverty rate for female-headed Hispanic families compares about the same, 53% in Utah, 55% nationally. Female-headed families in Utah represent only 13% of all families, but they are 47% of all families in poverty. Much has been said nationally about welfare mothers and the growing numbers of unmarried women who are mothers, the impression being that we would deal with welfare with the poverty of female-headed families if we can just get women to stop having babies unmarried. However, in Utah, only 17% of all currently unmarried mothers over 15 are never married, compared nationally to 35%. Utah single mothers are more likely to be employed than single mothers nationally, but they also have more children to care for, the result of that high fertility rate in the early 80s. The wage gap is greater in Utah than nationally, which creates a double whammy for the female head of house who is attempting to support her family on one income that is a female wage. Single female parents in Utah earned an average of 6% less in 1989 than 1979, compared to 1% decline for U.S. single female parents. As we learned earlier, most married couple families are unable to live on one income, even though that income is a male wage. While the labor market is expanding in Utah, the wages for women's jobs are low, and women in lower-paying jobs are least likely to be provided childcare by their employers. The state does provide assistance to low-income families to purchase childcare services, but the eligibility level for assistance has been steadily lowered. Most childcare facilities that offer the highest levels of quality do not accept state assisted children because of the lower fees, and therefore state-assisted children must settle for poorer quality programs. Acquiring accurate information about Utah women changes our view of who we are and raises questions about what Utah ought to be doing for women. Excuse me. Like women nationally, Utah women are in the midst of adjusting to an economy where job growth is limited to a lower-paying economic sector. This impacts both their own ability to earn a good wage and, for married women, the ability of their husbands to earn a good wage as well. We see women who play a significant role in the financial support of their families and in the state's economy. While we can't say that women have unequal access to higher education, we can say that insufficient attention is being given to the need for women to be educated. We know that the wage gap, which declined during the 80s, is at least partly due to the unusually large education gap, and at least some of the education gap is due to the marriage gap. Utah's women are still marrying at a relatively young age compared to women nationally, although they are much more likely to be enrolled in school than those of the last decade. More attention must be given to the adequacy of the state's universities and colleges in preparing women for their future. We know that women of color, like their neighbors in the U.S., are especially vulnerable to poverty, and that female-headed households are 2 to 4 times as likely to be in poverty as married couple families, depending upon the race or ethnic group examined. We cannot ignore the gendered experience of Utah, nor can we ignore the inequitable distribution of opportunities for Utah's minority populations. The common stereotype of Utah women serves no purpose except to devalue and underestimate their contributions and to hide the reality of their lives. Thank you. Now, we have some time still, and this session is being broadcast, so they have asked that if you have any questions, to please step up to the microphone so your question is broadcast, and I'd be pleased to take any questions.
Yes, is there any evidence that the mid-'80s speech of Ezra Taft Benson urging women to return to their traditional roles in the home, that had any measurable impact at all on these demographics?
No.
Okay.
There is no evidence.
What's your sense? I mean, since there's no hard data, what's your sense? Is your sense that
well, the one thing that we can look at in terms of the data that's interesting, in 1980, the women in Utah with children, especially children under 6, was the one group that was lower than the women nationally. That was in 1980. By 1990, that group had caught up. So if there, you would expect that in the decade that he would have made that pronouncement, maybe that they would have held the line more. But they didn't. And by 1990, almost every category looks the same. The one category in which there is a lower labor force participation rate for Utah women is for those women who have children both under 6 and children 6 to 18. So we know that they have more children on average because they've got both younger and older children. But even that category is over 50% of women being employed. So I think what we would conclude is that if women are listening to those pronouncements at all, the way they're listening to them is they're working part-time instead of full-time when they have children.
Yeah. One other question also. When you cite statistics regarding single-parent, women-headed single-parent families and the incomes of those families, do court-ordered child support payments figure into those household income figures or not?
Yes, the in the census, the question is there's a question on wages, and then there's a question on how much support you got from other sources. So there's always a question about the reliability of the data, but there should have been included if the women included it in their census report.
And they're probably more likely to include what they actually get rather
than
what's been ordered.
That's right.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Maybe I missed it right up front, but I think an important piece of information that we need is what percentage of all Utah women are Mormon? And if it's high, is it okay to use that generalization to transfer it or to make claims about Mormon women? That's one question. I could ask them again, but just quick answers is fine with me. When you said that 3 out of 10 men have college degrees, while 1 in 5 would do for women, that doesn't. I guess nothing short of equity is always a bad thing, but 2 out of 10 versus 3 out of 10 doesn't seem that bad to me. Well, as far as stats go.
Depends on whether or not you're a man or a woman, I guess.
that's correct. At the same time, you know, that's the problem with statistics. I mean, the degree is negligible, perhaps.
When you're talking about thousands.
The third question is just a simple one. Is this for further study? What sources do you recommend?
Okay, let me address your first question about, and I assume you're sort of responding to his question about whether or not it would have an effect on Utah women's working. President Benson's statement.
No, I won't.
Oh, okay. Well, I think that was the point I really started out with, that. To study Utah statistics doesn't tell you much about Mormonism. It tells you about Utah. But aside from that, about 70% of Utahns are LDS. But once you take into account also those who are regular attenders, I think you really get down to maybe half or a little less than half of Utahns. So the other thing I think we need to take into account is that we really seem to have two different populations in Utah. One is the people who are churched, that is, belong to a religion, and those who are unchurched. If you look at the churched, of course, the Mormon group is the largest. The next largest group are the Catholics. Now, Catholics also have a lot of prescriptions around importance of family and particularly birth control. So, and since the census data do not ask religious preference because church and state are separate, we're not able to make that distinction. So that should answer that question. And then your third question was. Additional research. I would frankly like to see some additional work done on first the issue of child care. We have just as many women employed in this state as nationally on a proportionate basis, but they tend to have one more child, which means the child care issue is that more important to look at in Utah. I feel like Now, there have been some national studies done on child care and where women and men go to find places for their children, and that data generally suggests actually a high percentage of families who are involved in child care and a fairly low percentage of the, you know, daycare providers. We need to know those numbers in Utah. We need to know what the problems are relative to child care. A second area of research that I think needs to be done is the climate on Utah college campuses. And because there definitely is a difference in terms of just the rate of women who are getting bachelor's degrees and the decisions that women are making about which school they're going to go to. women are self-selecting certain schools, and they seem to be selecting the smaller schools. We need to understand that that process. And then the third area is in terms of women's employment, the wage gap, and those kinds of questions. So I'd like to see the state take an active effort to maybe do some surveys and get some information about those three areas.
I would just like you to clarify. I think you may have made this point, and I just missed it. My understanding is nationally that there had been a drop in the birth rate through the early 80s and that, but that there has been a jump now recently. Could you just repeat over the last, 20 years, is there a dip in the Utah birth rate and then a rise or a steady decline? Or just what's the situation compared to nationally?
Let's see. Tim Heaton's here, and he can correct me if I'm wrong. My look at the data is that nationally it declined dramatically and then started up. Utah, it declined. Is it on the up, Tim, for Utah? I don't think it is. Yeah, it really declined quite a bit, and then the U.S. started up to meet it. But there's still that difference there.
Apparently, fewer women are completing college, and yet we have more women in poverty. Is this directly correlated, or are there other things, or has this been studied?
No. I think my guess is there are more women. If you make a comparison over time, there are actually more women completing their college now than used to be. In terms of the poverty issue, I think it's a number of effects. One is simply the greater number of women who are on their own with children. But the combination of that is the lack of opportunity for women who are in poverty to get good jobs where they could support their children.
Well, I guess my question is, are there grants and aids, state agencies, that make it possible for women in poverty to go to school to get out of poverty?
Well, that's one of the things that they're trying to work on now in terms of even aid to dependent families with dependent children. One of the, a classic example of the problem we have in terms of the way we administer welfare is that is the one case of the woman who wanted to go to school. Had saved some money, finally had enough money to get a car so she could be able to drop her children off at daycare, go up to the university, in relatively short interview intervals rather than on the bus. But as soon as she had sufficient assets to buy a car, they took her off families with dependent children. Now, Utah has, my understanding is Utah has some fairly forward-looking test trials going on, trying to figure out ways to help women move beyond poverty. And the nice thing about it is we have this group, the Jedi Women, who are they're watching every move those legislators make. And I think they're doing a good job pointing out the areas in which we really don't serve women in poverty, but we keep them there. And one of the ways in which we keep women in poverty is we still assume that the best way to get a woman out of poverty is to get her attached to a man. And the dilemma for many of these women is one of the reasons they're in poverty anyway is because the man they were attached to was abusive. So we need to figure out ways in which to help women become self-sufficient so they don't have to be in those abusive relationships.
Marie, something else I think we assume is that if the best way to get a woman educated is through a state or government grant, which most of us have assumed if she's really in poverty. I just found out because a teenager close to me is working in one of the fast food places. But if he will work or she would work 35 hours a week, that that fast food place will pay pay full tuition at the UVSC. Now, that seems to me a direction I hear things happening in. The business is stepping in instead of just saying, okay, it's got to be the government. But the business is stepping in and helping all sorts of people to complete their education while working. I don't know if you have demographics on that, but I think that's a hopeful move.
Well, the only actually demographic that I have that's quite interesting is that Utah teenagers have a higher labor force participation rate than teenagers nationally. And for women, it's particularly high. One of the reasons that our labor force participation rate is high in Utah, in fact, it's not just the women with children, you know, that are 30 years old, but it's the 16 and 17-year-old women between 45 and 50% are employed, you know, after school or doing whatever. And that's much higher than nationally, by about 10% higher.
If the statistics indicate that more women are finishing degrees and yet they marry sooner in Utah, are there statistics that indicate that newly married couples are delaying childbirth until the woman attains the degree?
Yeah, I think there is. If you look at, if you make a comparison of the percent of women who are married in Utah with the percent who've had their first child by, you know, in that young age group, there is quite a gap, which is not the same in the rest of the country. In fact, in the rest of the country, at the younger ages, the percent who've had their first child is higher than the percent that's married. So the statistics seem to suggest that Utah women get married and have sex. U.S. women get married to have children, or when they have children. Okay?
Those are the choices, is that it?
No, that's not the two choices.
Thank you.
Excuse me. All I'm doing is talking about when they marry and when they have their first child. There are still upwards of 30% of the population who aren't married, of course. But in terms of those who do marry, the reasons for why they marry are very different. And I think that has an effect on even education and labor force participation, too, because Utah women's life cycle is different, I think. And we don't quite have the data to look at that. But they get married in their younger 20s, delay their the birth of their first child for a while. And, in fact, there is a high fertility rate among Mormons, but there are also pretty strong norms about spacing of those children and how soon you have them. And those norms, I think, are changing for the younger group, saying you're married for a while and then you have children and all of that. But in the U.S., I think women are delaying marriage and childbirth. And that's one of the reasons why our birth rate is still higher than nationally, although we've had a greater decline in birth rate among the young women, those 15 to 24, the decline in birth rates is higher for Utah women than for women nationally. So there is a difference.
What do we know about the single-parent families with children at home headed by males?
I don't have those numbers with me, but in terms of the numbers that I gave you, married couple families do the best. Only about 8% are in poverty. Female-headed do the worst. And the male heads are somewhere are about halfway in between. So that the male-headed families are more likely to be in poverty than the married couple families as well. And I think that's as well a reflection of the difficulty of maintaining a family in a without two incomes these days. The other thing, though, that I want to point out is that the male-headed family is not a large percent of the people in poverty. The large percent of the people in poverty are the female-headed. It's 47% of all... I don't recall the figure. It's, but it's much smaller than for the female. Since this is going out over the radio, I don't want to make a guess. We've got a question behind before we take her.
I came in late, so I hesitate to ask this, but are there statistically significant numbers of male family, male head of household families in Utah?
Oh, yeah. There are, I'm trying to think in terms of the numbers. There are male-headed households, and there are more of them than in 1980, but my recollection is it's only about 3 or 4% of the households. But don't take me on that, because I'll have to look that up. But it's relatively small. As far as I recollect, there wasn't much difference, but I don't recall. Any other questions? Oh, yes, Marianne.
I do have one more question. And maybe you don't know the answer to this, I don't know. The welfare system of the church, I know, gives foodstuffs and clothing.
Yeah.
Does it provide educational opportunities or money for those kinds of advancements for women in poverty?
Not that I know of, but I'm not aware of what opportunities are there. Except that they raise a lot of money for scholarships at RICS and BYU. I don't know. One of the problems, I think, at BYU relative to this is that there really isn't much of a focus on non-traditional women students at BYU. That's fairly typical of large private universities, however, who don't have to really serve the state. But basically, the women who are in transition and needing to go back to school and whatever are getting better support and reinforcement, I think, I think they get the most reinforcement at the community colleges. I've heard good things from these women about Weber State, but I don't know that there's enough attention to it at the larger universities.
You said most of the job growth for women has been in the service industries.
Yeah.
And that's mostly, I don't see that as being good for people because those jobs are less likely to provide health benefits and all that, and also much likely to provide retirement plans. And so it seems like 20, 30 years down the road, we're going to have a lot more problems because women have filled those positions rather than if women were somewhere else. What do you think can be done to try to change that pattern from here?
I think it is true. For example, a lot of the larger retail outlets are hire people for less than 30 hours a week so they don't have to pay benefits. Of course, the women want to have those kinds of jobs because they want part-time jobs, so that they're willing to fill them. And then the stores, I think, do take advantage of that. Short of law and legislation, I suppose we could discourage people from shopping at stores who hire a certain proportion of part-time people. Except that would harm the women who need those kinds of jobs and want those kinds of jobs. Actually, in terms of health care that you bring up, I mean, we've always had problems with Social Security that we've never fixed. But the other thing that, as I've talked to women around the state, that I would love to know more about, and we don't know much information, are the number of women that I hear of who are employed simply to get the health benefit. That is, for some reason or another, their husband does not have the health benefit. So they will look for a job where it may be a low-paying job, but that job provides the the family with the health benefits they need.
Could you talk a little bit more about why women don't go to the U and what the U's trying to do to change their climate?
I really don't know. I've only been up there for a year. Part of it may just be the size. Part of it, certainly the focus of the University of Utah is on the medical school and the law school and the business, you know, their graduate programs. They are the one institution in the state that really focuses on graduate school education. BYU has a few graduate programs, but for the most part is a liberal arts college. Excuse me. I'm not sure I have any answers, except that I do need to raise the question about the extent to which the conflict over Mormon-non-Mormon tensions at the University of Utah may discourage some women, and the fact that there aren't many college professors at many of the institutions. You actually get more female instructors at the community colleges than you do at the larger universities, and that may be one reason why women like to go there, because they can have instructors who are like them. But these are all just guesses, and I think we need to take a hard look at what we're doing in this state in terms of community colleges and state colleges and make sure that women feel have the opportunities at those institutions. Do you have a question?
I'm aware that in Quebec, between 1950 and 1980, the influence of the Catholic Church politically in the province dropped precipitously, and at the same time, the birth rate went from the highest in Canada to the lowest in Canada, and is well below replacement now. Do you foresee the possibility of anything like that happening here?
The birth rate would go below zero?
In Quebec went from the highest province in the country to the lowest birth rate.
Yeah. No, I don't see that happening. We have enough Latter-day Saints in the state who firmly believe in the in their role as creating families and having children, that I expect that Utah's birth rate will always be, it's always been higher, and it will always be higher, but it moderates based on social or economic changes, just like the birth rate in the United States moderates. So, I mean, there are a lot of things that influences that birth rate. But I don't think it'll go below zero. Not until they put something in the water. Or take out what's in the water. Any other questions? Kind of covered it? Okay, well, thanks for coming.
And thank you for joining us for another session coming to you live from the Sunstone Symposium at the Salt Lake Hilton Hotel in Salt Lake City. We've been listening to a paper by Marie Cornwell called Beyond Fertility, What We Don't Know About Utah Women, in which she looks at the at new statistical data about women in Utah that focuses not just on fertility, as traditional statistics have, but on data about employment, occupation, educational attainment, mortality rates, and the wage gap between men and women, and the different kinds of choices that women are making, and the impact that that's having on LDS society, Mormon society in general, and the Utah State society in general as well. Just a reminder that all the sessions you've been hearing and sessions that you'll hear later will be broadcasting until 6:15 are available on tape And you can call 532-3344 and ask for the Sunstone desk. And we can give you more information about tapes and also about different sessions that will be occurring during the remainder of this day that will not be broadcast. We have generally about 6 sessions during the course of any given hour, and they range in variety from everything from plays, which we will have coming up during the 2:15 hour, to papers about environmentalism and Mormons and the death penalty, a therapist talking about healing the church intellectual rift, and a session on contemporary Mormon poetry. And of course, for those sessions, we would invite you to come to the Salt Lake Hilton to find out more about them and to see what they're about. Otherwise, you can tune in at 2:15 when we'll be returning after our lunch break for another session that will run for about an hour. And we'll be hearing Ken Driggs, who is a senior staff attorney at the Texas Resource Center and who represents death row inmates and argues against their execution. And he'll be presenting a paper that he calls Reflecting on the Death Penalty as a Mormon. So until 2:15, we will return to the studios of KCPW.